I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a man who had a rather unconventional idea, a way to bring something different to the refugees of Darfur. Patrick McGran wanted to offer one thing that others weren't bringing in for the children there, and that was fun. He took in kite-making supplies, enough to make so many kites that he and several thousand refugee children might take a crack at the world record.
And we had probably maybe about 15,000 children who were interested in flying the kites, and we manufactured approximately around 4,500, so we had a good 2,000 kite buffer to make sure that we broke the world record.
Patrick hadn't anticipated that the kites would be too popular, but the locked steel case where they were stored in the refugee camp was regularly being pilfered. So he found that with that and the language barrier and the fact that older kids and adults also wanted to play just as much as the youngsters, that the kite venture did more than just fly. It made a difference. I'll talk with Patrick after the news. A few months back, Patrick McGran went to a refugee camp in Chad, a place where thousands of people from Darfur have gathered for safety. He took with him an armload of kite-making supplies. Once the people there realized that Patrick wanted to help them make kites and fly them, he says everyone wanted a turn.
And I'd see these men who were, 180, 200 pounds just disappear below a pile of children, and then kites just go everywhere. But as I continue to hear on a weekly basis, I get emails from friends and colleagues who work in the refugee camp saying, yeah, your kites are up every day, in different parts of the camp. Some of them we made, some of them that were made there, but we've certainly introduced a kite culture there, and it's certainly taken.
Patrick discovered one universal truth about life in a refugee camp, and that is that there's one thing even medicine, food, and water can't fix, and that's boredom. That's where the kites come in. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
This is often what we hear in the pleas to get help to the people from Darfur.
The tragic situation in Sudan is one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world today. Nearly 3 million people, many in refugee camps, depend on international food aid for survival. You can help the people of Darfur.
Patrick McGran knew that was true. He knew he could help, but he'd already been part of another United Nations effort in Africa. He'd seen what worked there and what didn't. So he set out to take kites to the people from Darfur, people who were stuck living in these refugee camps in neighboring Chad.
The entire region, especially the main camp we were working in, is as horrible as you could possibly imagine. About the only beautiful thing is the resilient spirit of a lot of the different people. But otherwise, these places are pretty horrible. There's so much stress and so much time and so little to look forward to.
Patrick knew that the kids would like the kites, but he didn't want to just hand them out. He wanted to get the refugees involved in making them.
And the first day we go over there, we cut them into preformed sled kites. Nothing different than you'd probably see at a park on a summer day and wherever you are. But then to have the children decorate them with different designs. So you have a lot of pictures of people shooting at helicopters and planes bombing villages. And you get a lot of that being expressed. So it was very bizarre seeing that conflicting approach where you have something peaceful like a kite, but then you'd have, outright war being expressed on it with a three-year-old drawing this. But it was beautiful to see them expressing themselves. And then you just, include two millet sticks on the side, take some really nice string. And the next thing you know is you've got a kite that's virtually indestructible. It's very windy, in the middle of the desert. No trees as far as the eye can see. In this little clearing in front of our tent, just standing in the sand, and we throw out a kite. And you have one or two people come the first day. Maybe 3 hours later, maybe you have 200 people kind of keeping an eye on things. Then you put the kites away. The next day, you put a kite up, and within 2 minutes, you've got 400 people. And it's just trying to keep order of passing the kite from one person to another to get a feel for it, to have them pull on the rope and feel the tension and get some of the bigger kids trying to vent a lot of their angst, just trying to yank the kites out of the sky. But the kites just kind of flex and smile and, bounce back to their original shape. You kind of have to teach these children what it's all about. They built up such a defense mechanism to so many new things that you really kind of have to earn their trust. But I think kites kind of explain themselves and their intent rather quickly. So within about 5 or 2 minutes, it was, wow, this is pretty cool. And I think the most profound thing I noticed was with the young girls and even elderly women. Maybe they're not allowed in these camps to play soccer because they're not good enough or because it's a men's sport. But with kites, there are no real rules on what people can do. So they could, and it was kind of just seeing this whole new world open up in their eyes. So a lot of my colleagues in these refugee camps said, something changed. As soon as we started introducing kites in this refugee camp, the whole general attitude just started to change. It was almost like we introduced license to smile again. I think something like that is pretty accurate.
And did any of the refugees talk to you, say anything to you about the kites?
Oh, yeah. You get a tremendous amount of thumbs up. You get, this is good. You get pats on the back. You get a lot of nodding and smiling. I mean, these people would come up and they'd shake your hands and they'd say, you know, in broken English, you get a lot of kites good.
Patrick McGran had already taken kites into places like Malawi and Kenya to see how his idea might work. He says it took him time to figure out what the kids wanted, what the pecking order would be for play, and how to make it all work.
Mostly the children we're dealing with, I'd say anywhere from 3 to 4 up until, you know, the early teens. But what usually happens is you go into one of these areas with a wide variety of ages. And of course, it's the younger children, and especially it's the girls a lot of the time who will embrace these new approaches. Hey, you know, I want to play with a kite. Well, some of the adolescents will kind of scoff and say, I'm too cool for this. But then as they see the younger children having so much fun, and they say these aren't exactly traditional kites. I mean, these things they're pretty cool. They're pretty huge.
These are big box kites. What are you flying?
Imagine small hang gliders of sorts. But we bring a variety of kites and a variety of colors to really stimulate different imaginations.
Right.
But these by no means are small kites. We do a variety. Whether we're giving away thousands of kites, those would be on the smaller scale. Yet we always try and bring some larger kites, almost that could, you know, pick up a grown man with a good gust. These are things we have to be careful of. But the smaller children would love these things, and then you kind of have a bell curve where some of the older children would be like, whoa, I want to get involved in this. This is pretty cool. And then as they tire with it after 4, 5, 6 hours, then some of the younger children would get back involved. And maybe you have a, you know, 15-year-old kid who weighs 150 pounds flying one of these kites, and it'll be a windy day. As he passes off, he'll pass it off to 5 or 6 4-year-olds who are almost the same weight, who are running around with the same kite. Sometimes in some of the regions we work, some of the boys try and, I don't know, push the girls down a little bit. But we have to be very active as far as making sure everybody gets equal time. But it's certainly not age specific.
Have these kids ever flown a kite before? Or do you have to teach them basically what's going on, or do they pick it up pretty quickly? How does that work?
Some of the people in some of the orphanages or some of the refugee camps have seen a kite, or where you kind of explain it, or where you're having to sneak stuff through customs and explain what it is. And eventually, after like 20 or 30 minutes, you get the, oh, I remember that. I've seen one of those once. So there's that introduction that you have to deal with quite often. But then, you know, within 10 minutes, curiosity takes over for itself. There's something I can do maybe in teaching how to manufacture kites and teaching some of the physics and the dynamics behind it for a grand total of about 15 minutes. And after that, the children probably know more than I do.
Yeah. Ever a time, though, when you were actually worried that one of these big kites might lift off with a child at the end of the string? I mean, the winds can get pretty strong there, right?
We had one area we were working with in northern Kenya, but it was on the edge of this bluff, and they said it got very windy toward the end of the day. So we had these two huge kites that, you know, both have, you know, 20 or 30 square feet of surface area on them, and you could pull them in one by one, but unfortunately, the two of them had gotten tied together, and we'd anchored them on this basketball hoop. And the wind started to pick up, and we're like, we need to bring these kites in. And because you had to pull them in together, we probably had 6 or 7 guys or full-size men trying to bring these things in. And I have to say we were lucky to bring them in because the basketball hoop was even starting to bend.
Wow. The kites themselves, I mean, my kite flying experience is really not the sort of thing I would want to boast about because I tend to lose them more than I fly them. The string breaks or, you know, they'll land in a tree or something like that. Is this an issue when you're flying the kites with the kids in Africa that they'll take off, they'll disappear, they'll be destroyed? How does that work out?
Because these children have so often faced so many different things, we only want to make the strongest of kites. You know, we want to make a kite that you could mash up as much as possible and run over with a car and rip in a tree and put it in your microwave and everything else and just still have it just smile and be looking for more trauma. We need something that's so dependable and so reliable that the children can kind of count on it. They don't want to be disappointed yet again. It's great to see the children just beat the hell out of these kites after weeks and have absolutely nothing happen to them. So I think the biggest problem we have is some of the kites disappearing in our facility in a refugee camp just over the border in Chad from Darfur. I think it was 4 nights in a row that our steel lock boxes were broken into to steal some of the kites we were going to give away the next day anyways. Yeah. But that's 99% of the problem we have. Maybe, you know, sometimes there are mistakes. Sometimes some of the kites don't work as well as they should. But I guarantee you there aren't any kites that are left in trees for lack of interest. If a kite ends up in a tree, you'll have a waiting line of people trying to get up there to get it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Patrick McGran had a plan for his kites and his kite-making supplies in the refugee camp. He wanted a world record. He had enough kites. He certainly had enough kids. He figured he might be able to get as many as 2,500 or 3,500 kites aloft at the same time.
It was so wonderful to seeing everybody band together, seeing the local community leaders in this refugee camp embrace it, seeing the United Nations get on board, seeing even the military want to get involved. It was so wonderful. We had so many different instances where you'd have people from the Chadian army like set down AK-47s against a tree to fly one of our kites. That was kind of the vibe that was so quickly embraced by pretty much everybody.
Did you break a world record?
We did not officially set a world record because our distribution of the kites was so chaotic. We broke a world record in my own mind as far as how many people got involved in manufacturing these kites. We had dozens and dozens of parents and all these children with special needs and all these other adolescents getting involved in making kites. We had all the children decorating the kites. That was wonderful. And we had probably maybe about 15,000 children who were interested in flying the kites. And we manufactured approximately around 4,500. So we had a good 2,000 kite buffer to make sure that we broke the world record. But then between all of the kites getting stolen in the middle of the night, and as soon as you carry out 30 or 40 kites at a time that they were going to start to distribute, and I'd see these men who were, you know, 180, 200 pounds just disappear below a pile of children, and then kites just go everywhere. But as I continue to hear on a weekly basis, I get emails from friends and colleagues who work in the refugee camp saying, yeah, your kites are up every day, you know, in different parts of the camp. Some of them we made, some of them that were made there, but we've certainly introduced a kite culture there, and it's certainly taken.
I know how I would react in a situation like that, having set a goal of getting that many kites in the air and then not reaching it. I'd be torn because, you know, oh, we didn't set the world record, but then there's all these kids spiriting away kites because they're such a treasure thing. Were you also feeling like, oh, this is good, no, this is bad, this is good?
Well, I think there was about 30 seconds of dismay in seeing some of my partners just start to pass out the kites willy-nilly instead of putting them in the air, or seeing people just get attacked to grab the kites, and you kind of have to shrug your shoulders and be like, that completely sucks. But then after about a minute, it kind of dawns on you that it's not about me and it's not about setting a world record. That the kids in this refugee camp probably never heard of the Guinness Book of World Records. And you just have to say, now that this is done, what else can we do? So we're starting up another kite manufacturing facility within this refugee camp where the refugees can make kites. And then we'll ship them via a few different United Nations agencies to different refugee camps, almost refugees working for other refugees or refugees giving gifts to other refugees. So that's been our reaction. It's not how can we look back and say, oh, that's horrible. How quickly can we get home? It's how quickly can we expand this in other areas?
It was actually a former girlfriend of Patrick McGrann's who gave him the idea to take kites to the plains of Central Africa. But it was Patrick who'd already decided that some of the more traditional ways of delivering aid were not working as well as we might think. And I'll talk with him about that when I'm back in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. And the story of the man taking kites to the kids in the refugee camp for Darfur actually came to me from one of you. Kellyanne Klink from Mankato, Minnesota, wrote to say that she'd read about Patrick and his organization called Kite Gang. And she said she wanted to hear Patrick and thought the story would be a good place to do that. Well, she was right. Patrick told me that his passion for Africa began when he worked for the UN at their World Food Program headquarters in Rome. But Patrick discovered that many of his co-workers were not what he expected. He remembers they were getting ready to fly to Africa for a conference in 2002.
I was shocked because there were a number of my colleagues who wouldn't go to the World Summit on Sustainable Development, which I considered a very big deal, not because they couldn't get a seat or not because it wasn't paid, but simply because all the business class seats were taken between Italy and South Africa. And personally, I mean, give me a shot to go to the World Summit on Sustainable Development and I'll fly jump seat, you know, put me in the cargo hold, I'm happy. I have to say that that was a little troubling, and I certainly didn't keep that to myself either.
Yeah, what happened? Did you talk to them? Did you confront someone?
I think I could probably recall myself putting my head in my hands and just being utterly exasperated along the lines of, you have to be kidding me, and how could you possibly turn down an opportunity like this?
So what did you do?
I basically said I think my time, at least at headquarters with the United Nations, was up. And I did not renew my lease for an apartment. And I said goodbye to all my colleagues. Thank you very much. It was a wonderful learning experience. And I decided to head to Central Africa and East Africa myself, because at the time, this was 2003, everyone at the United Nations food agencies was claiming that there was a large famine erupting in Ethiopia. And so I thought, if I really want to make a difference, and if I really want to get away from some of these things that I've experienced at headquarters, I want to go on my own dime and see the famine for myself. I had come from many different experiences around the world where I'd seen poverty, but supposedly this was the apex. This was as bad as it gets. So headed to the train station in Rome and said, you know, give me a ticket to the south. And then I got there, and then I said, you know, give me a ferry to Eastern Europe. Went to Albania and just proceeded to keep moving country through country until I could make it down to this village where the famine was supposedly based. Spending time in a number of other poor countries, I'd really seen quite a bit. And so by the time I made it to this particular region of Ethiopia, I have to say I was a little disappointed, because there were a number of livestock, there was a lot of water, there was plenty of vegetation. I'd kind of been raised on the whole Sally Struthers, you're out there in this arid plain and everything's horrible and all you can see are rib cages as far as the eye can see. So that's really what I was expecting. That was my orientation going in. So I have to say I was a little surprised at the abundance of different resources, at least in the area that the World Food Program was telling me to go.
So what were you thinking when you saw that?
My initial reaction on all this is wonderful that I was able to see this, because obviously there's a disconnect somewhere in the process, whether it's there's a legitimate need there and this is just a way to bilk rich countries for more money, or there's a need that is being funded at some different level that I can't see. But it was good just to be there to understand that my initial assumptions were off base.
But I mean, was there a part of you thinking this whole thing's a scam?
I don't think I'd use the word scam. I think I'd just probably more go along the line of misinformation and misunderstanding. And the fact that I think there are a lot of people who work for both food agencies and NGOs in Africa and other countries that do recognize that there are very legitimate needs in a lot of these areas. I'm certainly not saying anything to the contrary,
right.
But it's not what you were expecting. It's not as poor as it would be.
Patrick McGran came back to the U.S. from Africa and decided he could make a better contribution by starting his own project to help people. But he wasn't sure what to do. At the time, he was helping a girlfriend tidy up some of her family business matters, and in the end, the two of them wound up with a share of the money, close to $100,000.
So the two of us talked, and we said, what do we care about? And one of her family legacies was kites. I think it was her grandfather's kite. Her grandfather, a Canadian fellow, was a huge kite enthusiast. And also, it was a simple approach. They're easy to manufacture. They're inspirational. They're joyful. So I don't have a traditional background in kites. It was her side that brought this to this, but I could see that there were certainly benefits.
Why kites, though? I mean, at a time when we're talking about, you know, are people going to get enough health care and do they get enough food and all that sort of stuff, what was your thinking about the value of the kite in a part of the world where they're lacking so many other things?
Basically, the first answer to that question is, what could we do? I'd contacted different organizations working with refugees in Darfur saying, listen, can we get involved? How can we help?
Right.
And I got no positive replies from anybody. I got a lot of thank you for replying, but it's almost impossible to get involved with larger organizations. You can send money, but there's really nothing else you can do. So we thought, what is some small way we could get involved besides just writing a check? So we thought, let's start small. And kites was just a very simple way that we could kind of bring economic development to a lot of these depressed communities that, frankly, when you're dealing with children that are so traumatized and have been through so much, whether they've lost their parents or whether their village has been destroyed or whether disease has ravaged a region that they live in, there's so much different trauma that needs to be addressed and needs to be worked through. We were trying to find what's a cost-effective way that we could get involved. And there are a lot of larger organizations that acknowledge that this is a very important way to do it, but they can't really promote it that much. You can't get on television and say, we have a famine, but we're also working with child therapy and we're introducing toys. We have a smaller organization and we can afford to take risks with our reputation. I'm happy to go on the radio and make a fool of myself and say, we want to deal with toys for these children who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, because if somebody doesn't want to get involved with us, that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know, from the larger markets.
No, I don't think it's foolish at all. I've spent time in refugee camps and know that one of the worst things that goes on in those places is boredom. And you've got all these kids with absolutely nothing to do. And you know, maybe getting them involved in flying a kite is some way of distracting them, taking their mind off it. But what exactly were you thinking? Were you thinking that you would get these kids building their own kites? What was the plan?
We started working with maybe 5 or 6 different orphanages in East Africa. And of course, giving away, you know, any types of toys or anything in these orphanages in sub-Saharan Africa is worthy. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to spend any time in an orphanage and give something away and think it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
But wanted just to start there and then slowly move up. We thought, well, let's start working in some of the slums to manufacture the kites that work as well. Because we could see the children, you know, tugging at these kites. We could see the joy. We could see the almost a lot of the pain, at least temporarily, kind of melting away. We thought, how can we add value to this? And let's go hire the people that no one wants to touch, that certainly would not qualify for traditional job training programs or have enough resources to start their own business. Let's really start to teach these people how to manufacture the kites we need to manufacture and then purchase the kites from them and then hopefully give them enough training as far as running a business as efficiently as at least we know how, and then hopefully provide them with startup capital that, so they can go off and use the training and the skills that they've acquired. So it's almost a de facto training program that we're starting to develop simply around kites, but then slowly expanding into different things.
So was there a time, Patrick, when you went to Africa on one of these sort of testing it out trips and, you know, had a chance to stand in a field somewhere with kids and kites and look around and see what the effect was?
Every single time. I think this is the first time you go and you don't want to make a complete fool of yourself being like, what am I doing here? Then everything just kind of takes off for itself. I'm thinking of this one day we had at an orphanage in Malawi, and I was so upset. We had one large kite, 20 feet wide here, and we needed to take it back because we had children in every orphanage sign off on their names and draw pictures on it. So it was kind of this heirloom of our organization that we wanted to keep, as well as leaving hundreds of kites there. But to take this one kite away from children who are having so much fun at the end of the day broke my heart. That's one of those times when you dedicate yourself and saying, okay, I'm never taking another kite or toy, no matter how valuable, out of these environments.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Patrick McGrann's work with kites not only brings some kind of distraction for kids in underdeveloped parts of Africa, he also says it has changed him. He thinks of the last time he returned to the U.S.
I think in the 3 weeks since I came back to Minneapolis, and I went to start my car, and it was maybe negative 20 that morning, and the engine blew up. And then 3 weeks later, you know, my laptop crashed, and a variety of these things seemed to be consistent over the last 3 months. But you just kind of shrug it all off and say, my life is absolute cake.
So what's next? More kites?
More kites. One of the big things in Africa, and in addition all around the world, are plastic bags. You have type 2 and type 4 plastic bags that we all deal with on a daily basis. Well, in Africa, they don't exactly have a lot of the trash distribution and recycling approaches that we so often invest in. And so you have the unofficial flower of South Africa is the plastic bag stuck in a tree. Well, that's true on every barbed wire fence and, you know, every post and every shrub you can find throughout Central Africa. So we're trying to develop a way right now, working with the University of Minnesota, to turn a lot of those plastic bags into toys. We're working on kite fabric and sheeting for refugees, but also anything we can kind of press into plastic molds. So whether it be Frisbees or rulers.
So what would you do? Have people gather up the plastic and bring it to some meltdown facility?
Exactly. The biggest problem with recycling plastic, as I understand in the United States, is distribution. Like, collection costs so much. Well, we have virtually free collection and logistics. You know, if we put out an announcement saying we're collecting plastic bags and we're paying, you know, $1 for 10 pounds, we'll clean house. We'll clean them in an area where we have abundant water. And then working with the University of Minnesota, we're developing the molding process. Right now, we're basically dealing with kites, but we want to expand into different areas of school supplies. And we're working on a prototype right now of an exercise ball that's about 6 feet wide.
Wait a second. An exercise ball that's 6 feet wide?
What we saw was the children pulling at this 30-foot kite and just venting their stress and their anger was so useful and so constructive. We wanted to see what would happen if we introduced, you know, a 6-foot-wide exercise ball, you know, bright red or bright pink or whatever, that the children wouldn't know how to react with it. That it's not a soccer game where you have 22 of the best players play every day, and that's those are the only people who play. We wanted to say, invent your own games and punch and kick these things, you know, to your heart's dismay. Just vent all that emotion that you've built up and that you need to share. But also invent games. Figure out what you want to do with this. We have so much plastic to use. We could just subsidize 200 of these large exercise balls for every NGO that wanted one in Central Africa, and they could use them if they wanted to, or, you know, pass on them. We'd basically go off what these different non-governmental organizations would ask for. If it works, we'll just, you know, throw as many as people want out there. It's great just to clean up the environment. It's great to make people feel better that they're getting involved in the entire process. They're not just waiting for a food shipment. They're out there, you know, bringing us raw materials that we can share with the people who are so often providing them services. It's kind of a great way that we're exploring to try and increase solidarity, both among the charities and among the refugees and the orphans, and just try and share something that hopefully will bring a lot of joy to the children. But, you know, this isn't the most rewarding thing financially, but spiritually, personally, every other approach you can have, it's absolute bliss.
Patrick McGran joined me from a studio in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can read more about him and his organization, Kite Gang. Go to our website. It's all at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Patrick talked of the plastic bag as the national flower of Africa, and it's a powerful image, all those little bits of plastic flapping in the bushes and the trees. Plastic is one of the world's worst pollutants, and that particular issue is something that's very close to the heart of Captain Charles Moore. For Captain Moore, it started with a sailing race from L.A. to Hawaii. He and his crew did well. They took third place and decided on a more leisurely return trip through a part of the center of the Pacific Ocean that's not often traveled. It's called the doldrums. It's a vast part of the ocean with very little current or wind, but as it turns out, lots and lots of pieces of plastic floating everywhere.
And when we made a decision to cross it, we didn't realize that it was going to take us a full week. Had no wind, no fuel. The rolling surface, I mean, I had to go up for repairs to the top of the mast, and it was an opportunity to see the debris. And, you know, I said, well, I play a game with myself. I'm going to bet that one of these times I'm going to come out on deck and see nothing but water. But that never happened.
You were always looking at some piece of, what, trash floating in the water?
Yeah, a bottle cap, a piece of plastic, a toothbrush, an oil can, some evidence of civilization. And this alarmed me because I'd sailed as a child to Hawaii with my father when I was 14, and I didn't remember anything like this.
Help me with what you're thinking at the time, because you're in this part of the ocean that's, I know I'm going to get in trouble with this, but it's kind of a dead zone, isn't it?
Well, yeah. You know, it doesn't have a lot of nutrients there. There's no upwelling from the bottom. You know, everything that ever lived in the ocean settles to the bottom and creates a kind of a compost and sets off a whole food chain. Well, you don't get that where it's 2-3 miles deep out in the middle of the ocean. And this area doesn't have a lot of currents bringing it nutrients from elsewhere, so it is a kind of an oceanic desert, about the same latitude as deserts on land.
And for that reason, I would have thought that it would be the last place where you'd find all this trash, right? I'd have expected you'd see it all around the coastlines.
Yeah, there's a kind of what I call a toilet bowl effect, clockwise current that's sort of sweeping the Pacific Rim and pulling the debris into the center so that you get a period of rotation of about 6 years with a tendency for the debris to be pulled into this vortex.
So if I threw a bottle cap, a floating bottle cap, into the ocean off the coast of California, it would take it 6 years to go up and around and then find itself into this dead zone in the center?
Well, 6 years to come back to you, about 5 years to get to the garbage patch, because it's about a year away from the coast.
What were you thinking when you saw all this trash in the water back in 97?
Well, I thought to myself, if I can travel 1,000 miles out here, and I'm going to guess that I was seeing something in the neighborhood of 0.5 pound of debris per 100 square meters, I multiplied that out, and I said, if the case is that the ocean is in this state, this alarming state of trashed condition, then that number is very, very large, and I need to scientifically assess this situation. So I came back convinced that I needed to talk to scientists who I had been working with on water quality monitoring and get a plan for monitoring trash in the ocean.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Captain Moore decided to work with the California Coastal Water Research Project to figure out just exactly how much plastic, how much trash is out there. So he took his research vessel out trawling with a wide scoop that could be pulled along the surface.
We did almost an equal amount of trawls at night and trawls at the daytime, and we did shorter and longer. And, you know, the distance between trawls was random, and the trawl length itself was random. That allowed us to quantify a kind of a circular area about 1 million square miles in diameter.
Now, I saw a video of the work that you do, and you're towing behind the catamaran a kind of an open mouth, like a big fish mouth, sort of.
It's a plankton net, and it's got a big wide mouth about 1 meter wide. It's got an opening about 6 inches. Hope you don't mind mixing English and metric
That's
units
right.
there. The mesh is 1/3 of a millimeter, which is a standard for this what we call noustonic or surface plankton.
Compare that to pantyhose or something that's fine mesh like that. Is it thicker?
Yeah, pantyhose would be finer than our net. Our net would be like a fairly fine screen for filtering tea bags or something like that.
Do you remember, Captain Moore, the very first time you pulled that trawl in to see what it is you found?
I do. I remember that. It was a shock because we hadn't got to where we thought all this trash was yet. We hadn't got out to the garbage patch. We were just about 500 miles from the coast in an area that had no particular relevance to our study, and we just thought we'd test the equipment. So we put it out there and trawled it for half an hour, something like that. And when it came in, we were shocked to see that it was populated with bits of plastic. And since that time, I've come to believe that the entire North Pacific, north of Hawaii, is populated with plastic.
And not just populated with plastic, but almost thick with this sludge of tiny bits of plastic that don't seem to be going away. This soup of shredded plastics, often mistaken by birds and fish and whales for food, and so it's also having a serious effect on sea life. In just a moment, more on the latest research looking at all that plastic in the water. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Last fall, on a single day in September, thousands of volunteers took to the beaches all over the world to pick up and tally up all the trash they found, everything from cigarette butts to candy bar wrappers to bottle caps. Now, these volunteers covered 33,000 miles of beach, and it was just announced this week that they picked up 6 million pounds of trash. Now, you do the math. That works out to about 180 pounds of junk for every mile of shoreline. None of this will surprise Captain Charles Moore. He was walking the California coast 50 years ago.
I remember my grandmother and I hunting for shells in the carved-out banks of the bay on which I live. And I was taught how to swim by the Red Cross at the Colorado Lagoon, which is an arm of Alamitos Bay where I grew up. And they would never think of conducting public swimming classes in that body of water today, as it gets an F. The levels of bacteria in that body of water now are so high that it's considered unsafe for body contact.
And what does it look like, that piece of shoreline? Is there trash strewn along there?
Not only is there trash, there's also a runoff of pet waste, and lawn fertilizer has created a bloom of a green mat. It used to be I would collect clams, and actually remember making a little fire on the mud at low tide and roasting clams from the area right in front of my house as a child. And now that area is clogged with a mat of green algae in response to the high nutrient loads that this bay has received from the urban hardscape.
For the past 10 years, though, Captain Moore has been way offshore, gathering up and studying what's floating in the ocean. To him, that's ever more sobering because it shows that the junk is not just washing up on the shoreline, and it's not sinking and disappearing. It's everywhere.
Well, you've got thin plastic films. That's about 1/4 of what we catch. Things that could be part of a trash bag, a Ziploc bag, a shopping bag. And we see maybe 5 to 10% are pre-production plastic pellets, the little, what we call nurdles, the little plastic resin beads that is the raw material of the thermoplastic industry that are melted to make most of the consumer objects that you get that are made out of plastic.
How do they get in the ocean? Because they're on their way to be made into something. They're not being thrown away.
Well, that's right. And it's just a consequence of the method of a shipment. And they're shipped in rail cars for the most part. And when a connection is made with the factory, it's done with a vacuum hose. And that little valve at the base of the tanker car that releases the pellets has to be shut and open just at the right time. And so I've actually walked on rail yards in which the ground between the rail ties felt like sand dunes of pellets. I mean, you sank down into them. That's 35 years or so of having spilled these things out a little at a time. And then when a rain comes, millions, even billions of them, we found 236 million in 3 days of sampling in the LA and San Gabriel rivers.
This is stuff that's just floating there on the surface of the water.
As soon as plastic is exposed to sunlight, it begins to photodegrade. It becomes embrittled, and it doesn't take a lot of energy to crack it. So you've got, after decades of floating around in the ocean and the salt water removing all the additives that have made the plastic supple, it's broken into chips. So by far and away, the most common type of plastic we find in the ocean is miscellaneous fragments.
Does it ever degrade into absolutely nothing, or does it always just hang there?
In the 50 years since the dawn of the plastic age, when consumer plastics have been throwaway products, there hasn't been enough time to get beyond the stage of photodegradation. At some point, which is undetermined, the individual polymer molecule will have been degraded itself to where something can eat it and turn it into carbon dioxide and water and a small amount of minerals. But estimates have been made from centuries to millennia, and no one really has a good handle on how long that takes.
Once you took your mannitol out into the area that you call the garbage zone, were you finding even more plastic out there?
Yeah, and smaller. I liken it to the cemetery where our plastics go to degrade. They don't die, unfortunately, in the sense of decomposing. But they do degrade and form smaller and smaller particles. So this last voyage, when we got to the garbage patch, I was spending a lot of time just picking tiny little fibers out of the nets, and I was digging those out. There were tiny little bits of that stuff just everywhere in the garbage patch, and I was digging that out of the mesh of our collection bag.
So I have this image of the mannitol that you described, sort of meter wide with a 6-inch mouth, and you're dragging it along behind the cat with this mesh sock behind it. If you were to go for an hour or two, I mean, how much stuff would you find? Could you fill a coffee cup with these bits of plastic? What would you end up
with? Yeah, you can fill a coffee cup with them. That's a good analogy. And that represents maybe a million pieces per square kilometer, you know, at least one per meter.
But you've been at sea for a long, long time. I just wonder if there's a time when you're out in the doldrums and you're looking, you know, ahead of you, behind you, east or west, you even shake your head at just the size of this area and consequently how much junk's in the water there.
Yeah, I think we're talking about an area twice the size of the United States, and we detoured from the normal route that we took on the way back from Hawaii and went west, you know, towards Japan this time. NOAA scientists had identified an area north of Hawaii there as a convergence zone for these ghost nets, and we wanted to see if that was also a convergence zone for plastic. So instead of an oceanic desert, we went to an area where we saw dolphins, you know, leaping amongst crates of coke that had been discarded. We went to an area where sharks were prevalent, you know, where there were a lot of fish, and found to our surprise and shock that this highway between the two garbage patches was more polluted than the garbage patch itself. The analogy I'm using is a cemetery in which the line of hearses waiting to get in with caskets outnumbers the number of graves already in the cemetery. So I was able to stand on the bow and just look. And I think what I'm going to use as a visual for you is a salt shaker on high coming down with sprinkled plastic bits on the surface. This is sort of what we're seeing. Individual, small bits here and there, as if they'd been sprinkled onto the surface of the ocean. So what we're talking about is a kind of a shade cloth over the surface of the ocean whose mesh is getting finer as we add more and more plastic to the mix.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Captain Charles Moore says the density of all this plastic that he finds on the surface of the ocean is now becoming so thick that the sunlight, which would normally penetrate the water, now can't.
It could have consequences for global warming, because if you take and stop the penetration of sunlight into the ocean, you're stopping the major organism which sequesters carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, the plant life in the ocean. And plants require photosynthesis to survive, and if you're blocking that out with little shards of plastic, you're creating a problem. Additionally, you're creating habitat for filter-feeding organisms which also eat these plants and deprive the resident population of its food. So we're changing the ecology. We're making a new habitat. We saw glaucous winged gull out where only albatross are normally found, you know, roosting on styrofoam floats, eating barnacles and crabs.
It's like a whole new ecosystem.
It's a brand new ecosystem. It's only been around half a century, and it's very, very wealthy in terms of recruited organisms to this plastic trash.
Aside from all these little pieces of plastic that you pull into your net, what are some of the craziest things that you actually find way out there floating in the water?
Hard hats. It seems safety equipment now is becoming mandatory, but it's also cheap. And plastic hard hats are a real common find out there, Russian ones, Japanese ones. We're finding a lot of toothbrushes. I'm not why so many toothbrushes. Find a lot of felt pens. Felt pens float really good. Even a plastic sheath for a knife we found out there, along with a CRT tubes, you know, the cathode ray tubes on the old-fashioned TV sets. We may find a lot more of those now that they're going to become outmoded. People will be getting rid of those en masse, and some of them won't make it to the landfill, I'm sure. We've found just about any kind of consumer object you can imagine that's lighter than water floating out in the ocean.
I used to work as a reporter in Prince Rupert up the Pacific Northwest of Canada, and we covered the fishing industry there. And I remember talking to the dockmaster once about, you know, where the fishermen bring their trash when they come back in from fishing. And he looked at me and he paused and he said, well, they don't. They just throw it in the ocean, you know. I mean, it'll disappear out there. I wonder if there are people who still believe that's the case.
Oh, there's no question about it. Most of the world's population does not have a history of consuming things that are not biodegradable. The food delivery system in Polynesia, for instance, was woven out of reeds and leaves. It wasn't plastic. So when you just finished with something and threw it down, it would only be there a week or a month or, you know, 6 months, and then it would become part of the ecosystem. The average person on Earth is still in that mode of thinking, that everything is dust to dust and doth return it. It just goes away. It's not programmed into us, this idea that plastics last forever. One of our pamphlets says plastic like diamonds are forever, to try to get the idea across that this is a new type of material that we're delivering our food in, and it has to be treated differently.
You're just back from a recent trip with some new trawling. What are you finding now? Is it worse than when you started out?
Yeah, we graduated from looking at the so-called garbage patch to looking at the entire North Pacific. And our voyage took us close to the international dateline, where we found higher levels than we'd ever experienced, even in the garbage patch. So the data that we accumulated is now being processed in our lab. But preliminary indications are that the quantity of debris over the last decade has gone up dramatically.
That's based on what you're pulling in just in your net, is that right?
Yeah. We also do kind of a census of debris on the surface. We have guys standing on the bow with a fish net, and anything that comes along, they pull it up. It's getting a lot easier to pull stuff up. It's not taking as long between pieces, and we're just finding more crap out there. It's pretty distressing.
Yeah, I was wondering how you feel about this, being someone who's grown up on the ocean, and clearly you have some affection for what we always thought was kind of like the purity or the cleanliness of that area out there.
Yeah, you know, I often stop the vessel in order to give the crew a chance to experience the deep blue out there as it actually is today. And I hand them a little aquarium net and a mask and a snorkel and some fins, and we just jump in for 10 or 15 minutes out in the middle of nowhere. And I have yet to do that without coming back with a piece of plastic in that net. It's shocking to the folks that come with me to find that we've been so good at populating the ocean with a new form of pollution.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Captain Charles Moore sees the plastic piling up in the ocean, I wondered if he ever feels like just tying up his vessel, staying on land, maybe getting work as a forest ranger.
You know, terrestrial birds like the condor are now eating plastic, so I think as a forest ranger I'd still be on the same subject.
I wonder, though, if you're inspired to keep going out there, to keep checking just to see it, or if you feel at times like giving up.
Well, no, we never give in the sense of resigning ourselves to the loss of our heritage. You certainly wouldn't give in if someone invaded your country and tried to take it from you, and you don't give in even though we're dealing with the tragedy of the commons, the property of all humanity.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is I was thinking prior to our conversation of the good news stories that I've heard over the past 50 years of cities and towns and people who have got together and somehow cleaned up a river, you know, a river that was horribly polluted that kids can now swim in. Is it even conceivable to think that at some point, with any kind of human activity, that the problem you're describing could be cleaned up?
Well, it can't be cleaned up directly in the same way that the ozone hole can't have the Boy Scouts on a Saturday go up and remove the chlorofluorocarbons so that, yeah, you know, the ozone hole shrinks. We can't have the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts out in the Pacific with little nets pulling up these fragments of plastic. The habitat is enormous. Its average depth is 2 miles. The stuff is mixed into the water column, and it's on the bottom. And we've just got to stop putting it in. The ocean will eventually spit it out. It won't be in our lifetime, but the ocean will eventually spit it out if we stop putting it in. And in order to stop putting it in, we have to assign it a value, and we have to collect it. Bottle bills do work. They maybe get 60% of the bottles back, but we've got to have a culture in which we change our way of thinking from extraction to reuse. You know, the age of extraction is coming to an end, and we're inaugurating the age of reuse. And the plastic in the ocean issue is a gateway issue to the whole concept of reuse of resources.
I mean, you've probably been watching and listening along with me over the past couple of years to the amount of attention paid to global warming, you know, fueled in part by Al Gore's campaign and other politicians who are saying, no, this is important, we need to do something about that. I wonder if you feel like the health of the ocean is somehow being left out of that equation.
I think there's a very aware community in my state, the state of California. We have an Ocean Protection Council. They have legislation banning the release of these pellets from plastic factories. They're working on a leash law, which I'm in favor of, that bottle caps be made non-removable from bottles in the same way that pull tops were made non-removable from beer and soda cans. Mm-hmm. These are things that are a start. You know, the world won't change overnight, but unless we start changing it today, it won't change in a century either. And then we've got millennia of this problem, and it's going to come back to haunt us because these plastics transmit pollutants. They absorb pollutants. They're sponges for our poisons, and I call them poison pills. So they're not just innocent pieces of confetti floating out there on the surface of the ocean. They're little poison pills transmitting all our hydrophobic pollutants throughout the food web. And it's impossible now for nature to make an organic fish out in the ocean. Huh. And if that's ever going to change, we've got to make some dramatic changes in the releases that humanity makes to the ocean. This is the kind of pollution you can see. This is the kind of pollution that's on every street. This is the kind of pollution that is upsetting every human being on the planet that has their food delivery system in plastic and their product delivery system in plastic. There's no take-back infrastructure for this packaging, and it's appearing everywhere. Humanity itself is upset by this drowning in our own litter.
Captain Charles Moore joined me from a studio at California State University in Long Beach. If you'd like to see some photos of the trash that he's been collecting and the work that he does on the good ship Algida, or if you'd like to read more about the plastic pile in the ocean, that's all on our website at thestory.org. Tomorrow on The Story, I'll talk with the woman singing this song. Mary Williams is a gospel singer who worries that the traditional black gospel music and spirituals are disappearing. She says it's like losing a link to the past. I'll talk with Mary tomorrow on The Story. If you have any suggestions of guests or stories to propose or reactions to things that you've heard on the program, the best way to get to me is through our website at thestory.org. But you can always call our telephone number and leave me a message there at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.